the studios of Central Coast Public Radio KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Norman Olsted is my guest. His new book is called Crazy for the Storm, and it tells the harrowing story of his escape from death when he, at age 11, survived a mountaintop plane crash. Norman Olsted, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit about your life before your ordeal. You were born in Southern California in the summer of love.
Yeah, 1967, and down on Topanga Beach, and which is at the mouth of Topanga Canyon in Malibu. It was a pretty eclectic group down there, I just remember as a little kid, there'd be a rock band playing or kind of a bluesy band playing right on somebody's deck on the beach, and I'd be out surfing listening to, you know, live music, and there'd be some people dancing and others do it, you know, one woman had a llama as a pet, I remember. So it was kind of like a circus atmosphere, festival atmosphere down there.
How old were you when you started surfing?
Well, those times I was like 5 or 6 years old and, you know, was just sort of barely riding at that point. But you could argue that I started when I was a year old because my dad strapped me to his back in a canvas papoose and went out surfing. And I have photographs that are actually in the book of him surfing while I'm on his back when I'm a year old.
Seems dangerous, though.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's his home break. It was, you know, 2 feet, the surf, and I don't think there was really much danger because it just looks worse than it really was.
Was your mother around? Your parents were divorced at some point. When
yeah, they got divorced when I was two. She was around for that, and she didn't see it happening. She was, I think the story is she was off shopping, getting groceries or something. It was a Saturday. And then she saw the photographs about a week later and put a stop to it. Said, you can't do that anymore. She was not happy when she saw the photograph.
Well, was that a source of conflict for your parents, just how to raise you and how to bring you up?
Yeah, God, you know, I think that, you know, well, they divorced when I was two. Mm-hmm. So, my dad was doing his own thing with me, and they stayed friendly, and he lived just on the other side of the Pacific Coast Highway, so like, you know, a few hundred yards away from the house on the beach. And but he just started sort of doing his own thing with me, and my mom didn't have much say in it. It was just kind of a different time.
Yeah. So your time was divided between, like most of us growing up then, your time was divided between your mom and your dad.
Right. Now, my father had a couple buddies on the beach right next to where my mom lived, and he also kept some surfboards at what became my mom's house, which used to be their house. So he was around the beach all the time and mixing with her, and so it wasn't like a separate world, but I think she just didn't really know, you know, he started taking me off skiing when I was 3 years old, and we went to Europe when I was 4 and 5 for a month each time skiing, and, you know, she didn't know exactly what adventures we were going on and you know, the kind of runs he was taking me on.
Well, I want to know about that, but first tell me about your dad. What your dad was an FBI agent?
Yeah, he did many things, wore a lot of different hats. He started out, grew up in South Los Angeles, very poor neighborhood, and he loved baseball, but his mom, my grandmother, would tear him away and make him go to these auditions at the studios and ride the bus across town. And he became a child actor. He played the oldest son in the original Cheaper by the Dozen. Mm-hmm. And he was on a show called Sky King, a TV show.
Sky
the mechanic.
King. Oh yeah, sure. We know that.
Yeah, yeah. And and some other little movies and stuff. And then he went to college, law school, and decided to join the FBI. He was an idealistic young man and wanted the most direct impact on what he thought was protecting, you know, the American way, freedom and justice, and joined the FBI under Hoover and pretty soon realized that it was a totally corrupt organization and hypocritical in a lot of ways, and eventually quit after a year, and then wrote a book called Inside the FBI, which came out the year I was born, 1967, and he got in a lot of hot water for that because it was one of the first books to challenge Ver's integrity. Hmm. And in those days, that was kind of a big deal.
I can imagine. So what did he do after that?
Then he worked for Robert Kennedy as an assistant district attorney. And then I think he worked for Southern Pacific and then went into private practice in Santa Monica.
As a lawyer?
As a lawyer,
And but, he, you know, in your book, he does some crazy stuff with you that, you know, you might even think today could even be, not child abuse exactly, but endangerment at least.
Yeah. You know, I write the book and leave it open to the reader to decide whatever they want about him or me or all those things. That's the style of the book and the narrative. I personally think it was a great gift that he gave me, and he really exposed me to beautiful things in life and got me right into the sort of like the throb of life right away, and I'm so happy he did. At the time, you know, I was resentful at waking up at 4 o'clock in the morning and, you know, having to hike through blizzards to get a little couple powder turns that he was crazy about. But, you know, now it's years later, it definitely paid off, and all those things that he taught me and the places he took me to, both physically and psychologically, really became a gift.
And what were some of those places? You went to Europe, you went to Mexico?
Yeah, well, my grandparents had retired to Puerto Vallarta, so I would go down there a lot and surf, and this one place called Sayulita, which has become pretty popular nowadays, but back then there was nobody around. And one time, I put it in the book, we had to deliver a washing machine to my grandparents down there, because in those days, it was just hard to get good appliances and so forth. So he went to Sears, he bought it, and we took this pickup truck down the Baja Peninsula, crossed the Sea of Cortez on a ferry to Mazatlan, and then drove the mainland down to Puerto Vallarta. And we surfed along the way and got into all kinds of trouble and trying to find some good surf. And my dad had a pretty short temper, and he was tired of paying the federales off to get the washing machine through these little checkpoints. They still have those kind of checkpoints. I surf down there pretty often. And he ran one of them, and then we had to kind of hide out for a couple days and in this little fishing village, and there happened to be some of the best surf, you know, I had ever been around in my life. I think we just got lucky. And it was just, we had these great adventures together, you know, beautiful times together.
Well, and your father remarried.
He never remarried. Sandra was just his girlfriend.
His girlfriend. And how long had they been then together?
They had been going out for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. They weren't, you know, perfectly steady those 2 years. They had kind of a rocky up and down relationship.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Norman Olsted, and his book is called Crazy for the Storm. And so where were you all going in the airplane?
We were headed to Big Bear.
This was in 1979.
1979, February 19th. We were headed early in the morning. We flew in a four-seater Cessna out of Santa Monica Airport, headed to Big Bear, California, about 35, 40 minutes by air away. And we were going there to collect a trophy because I had won a ski race the day before, and I was going to train with the team as well that afternoon. And we had left Big Bear because I had a hockey game the night of the day that I won the ski race. So we were back in Santa Monica. And a few weeks before, my dad knew this was going to be our schedule, and we've been driving around. So he thought it would be fun to charter this plane, get somebody to fly us up there, and not have to do the round trip 2 days in a row. So we were flying up in the morning and flew right into a blizzard and crashed straight into Ontario Peak.
Well, there's not that many blizzards in Southern California. How did you guys happen to hit a blizzard? What was the deal?
Well, you know, December, January, February, you can get some pretty good storms just east of L.A. Those mountains are, there's a cluster of peaks, one's about 10,000 feet, the other one's 9-something, and that one we hit was 8,600. They're pretty steep formidable peaks right there, and they do attract, you know, there's some ski resorts, so obviously they get snow, and on a good year they get a lot of snow, and they really, the clouds, the storm that comes through there will kind of get trapped in there and bounce around and stay for a day or two sometimes. So, yes, we do get storms, and we just happen to collide right into one.
And how long had you been flying in the storm before you crashed? Tell us a little bit about that moment, if you don't mind. You know, about
So we were flying along, and the whole time I was nervous because I was sitting in the front with the pilot, and I saw the storm in front of us. We were just heading right into it, and pretty soon we were sort of nosed into the actual clouds of the storm, and the plane was jerking around, and then before you knew it, you couldn't see out any of the windows. It was just, you know, cloud pressing against the window, and it didn't even seem like we were moving, but we were jerking around, so obviously we were moving, and there was the noise of the engines, and I just slowly, the pilot started to panic, and so we were probably deep in those clouds for 3 minutes, maybe longer, the deepest, you know, from just nosing in till the end, maybe 10 minutes, but the deepest part where we really were just lost for about 3 minutes. A limb reached out of this void of gray a little bit below me, and I thought, and then disappeared right away, and I thought, well, you know, there's no trees up here. I was 11 years old. And then I turned to look at my father to sort of see, get a sense of what he was feeling, and I saw a limb reach out basically parallel to his window, and that's, I yelled, "Watch out," and I curled my body up, and I remember feeling three thuds, and then I woke up some time later, and the plane was ripped apart, and we were scattered, our bodies were scattered across this steep gully, which I call a chute, and it was a full-on blizzard.
How long do you think you were unconscious?
Yeah, I don't know. I kind of went in and out of it. I thought I was dreaming and went back to sleep, and then finally realized I wasn't dreaming because I was cold and just it was going on too long.
Mm-hmm. And so you looked around, and what did you see?
Well, first I saw some things that didn't make sense, like one of the wings of the plane was stuck into a tree, like up high in the tree, like a knife would be, and just very disorienting, and the fog would come and go, and the wind-driven snow, so it was, you didn't see it clearly. It would sort of be there and then disappear. And the instrument panel was, a piece of it was sort of right where I was. I was ripped out of my seat, but still on my seat belt. And there was just jagged pieces of metal ripped open. And finally,
sorry to interrupt. So, but when you woke up, you were no longer in the plane, or the plane was no longer there, or?
It was just ripped apart. Just sort of scattered apart. Uh-huh. I was still in my seat belt, but the actual seat was kind of ripped out of the plane.
Wow.
Except for some of the pieces were sort of halfway connected to it and around me. I remember when I first moved, you know, like did a big movement, a piece of the plane just shot away into the fog as if through a trap door. Wow. And I realized I was in a really steep chute. It turned out to be a 45-degree pitch. And because I'd been backcountry skiing with my father so many times and knew about ice and all these things, I was able to right away discern that I didn't want to slip at all, and I was on an icy, steep chute, and I had to be very careful, otherwise I would follow that piece to wherever it was going.
Wow. So what did you do next?
The first person I saw was the pilot, and he was sort of sprawled out, and I scaled across this ice sheet to him, and he was clearly dead, pretty damaged pretty heavily. And then Sandra was making some noise above him, so I talked to her a little bit, and she was very disoriented, and she was still in her seat too. And I finally then figured out that my father was really right where I started, behind my seat, but it was a steep pitch, and like I said, wind-driven, snow, and foggy, and I didn't see him there at first. So I made my way back and tried to wake him up and spoke to him and shook him. And I did that several times. I mean, it's a really, it was a nine-hour ordeal, so there's a lot of different things that happened. But eventually, after Sandra and I, we made our way over to the wing to take shelter. There was another, the other wing was at the base of a tree on the other side of the chute. And a couple times I went over to check on my father and try to wake him up, and I had to accept that he was, never accepted he was dead, but just that he wasn't going to be able to help me, and he was knocked out. I couldn't wake him up.
Hmm. Wow. It's so scary. So what did you guys do?
So, well, again, a lot of things happened, but let's see, the biggest moves were, there was a pause in the storm. I'd say about 10 to 15 minute break, and during that time, I heard a helicopter, and I sort of scuttled out from under the wing and the reach of this big tree we were under, and I, the feet of the plane came right, the helicopter came right above me, and I felt like I could just reach up and touch it, and I saw the pilot's helmet as it dipped in the wind and stuff, and they didn't see me. They didn't hear me. I was yelling and waving, and it flew away.
Mm.
And I looked down. For the first time, I could see some of the terrain below me and all the canyons and gullies, and I saw a rooftop of a cabin down in this forest where the terrain started to level out a little more and wasn't just pitching away. And I made a map in my mind very quickly. Again, it was natural because I backcountry skiing with my dad and stuff. You always had to kind of map out how you're going to get out of a situation, or you know, get to the highway to hitchhike back to the ski resort or something. So I just naturally did this. So the storm returned not long after that, and I was back under the wing with Sandra, and it was freezing and windy. We had no gloves, no hat. I had Vans tennis shoes on, and I realized, look, they're not coming back, and we're not spending the night here because we'll never make it. So we got to go try to get to this cabin.
So you were sort of taking charge rather than the adult taking charge.
Yeah, yeah, I had to. I mean, I had the advantage of, you know, I'd been in blizzards before, and I understood this terrain. So that part was not that intimidating. Of course, all the other stuff was. But, you know, sort of the point of the book is that my father had sort of unknowingly just train me to, you know, trust my instincts and stay focused on what was in front of me and what I had to do right now and not be distracted by the things that were just going to get in my way. And I kind of went into this mode, this ingrained mode of survival, and, yes, took charge.
Well, there's this little wonderful little news clip that's on your website of from CBS News of this little kid, 11-year-old kid, having survived this thing, and it's you. But I mean, when you look at this thing, do you think that's me? Can you relate to that kid? I mean, that kid's pretty amazing.
Yeah, it was pretty shocking when I saw that footage. That's the day after the crash, and just seeing myself kind of black and blue and bandaged up, and I had lost all the skin on my first knuckles on both hands, you know, digging my fingers into the ice all the way down. And over the years, I just sort of had played it down, you know, just, yeah, you know, I made it down, and I didn't really talk to many people about it, but I just, it was kind of like a dream that happened to somebody else, and I just did what I had to do, and that was that. But when I saw that, you know, a lot of the stuff came back, a lot of the stuff I had sort of buried away, and it shook me up a little bit to see how small I was and beaten up. And then the other part was that I was pretty calm, obviously sort of still in shock. And
You're totally calm in that clip. It's really strange.
Yeah, yeah. You know, It's nice that it's there, because when I saw that, I got back into the story, and really, I did a lot of research. I hiked the same route twice with one of the sons of the rescue guys, and all these things I did. And I really got back into the story, and I realized how a kid, myself as a kid, was just so much more perceptive and not really mature, but just evolved in ways that you just don't think kids are. And, you know, I have a son myself, which really helped me write the book, and I don't know if people would, or I even would have believed how perceptive I was at that time if I wasn't able to really go back into those times and sort of honestly recount them. And then it's nice to have that footage because I can point to it and say, yeah, my memory's right. I was like that.
We're talking with Norman Olstad, and his book is called Crazy for the Storm. Now, Sandra did not make it down. What happened?
Pretty soon after we started that initial descent, there were some incidents where she slipped a little bit, and basically I was below her. We were both on our stomachs. I was below her, and her shoes were perched on the top of my head or the top of either shoulder or both shoulders. And I had broken off some sticks, some limbs, branches, and made them into little ice axes, what I called ice axes, to help us, you know, axe into this snow. And she had a dislocated shoulder, and she was scared and disoriented. And I carried her weight for a long time as we made our way down. And we didn't move very far because you had to go inch at a time, because if you slipped at all, it was over. You were just going to keep sliding. And eventually she became separated from me by a few feet. And because I was concentrating on what was right under my nose and what was below me and being methodical, I didn't even notice it at first, and maybe because I was numb too. And by the time I did, and I tried to coax her back down to me, she was panicked, and she lifted her body up just enough. And when it's that steep and icy, she just toppled over and went shooting away down this gully into the fog. And I found her an hour later when I got out of that really steep initial chute, and she was dead. She had hit some trees and stuff on the way down.
Wow. So, I mean, there's just one trauma after another in this crazy story.
Yeah, you know, and that's only there to try to highlight and find a way to really show the manifestation of this relationship I had with my father, and how, yes, it was intense, and you could say, well, it was reckless on things, but it really gave me a perspective on life and a kind of optimism and a belief in myself that ultimately got me down that mountain and got me through my adolescence without my father and some stuff I had to deal with then. And I just think it was just a beautiful gift, even though it sort of came in an imperfect way, or a way that might be hard for some people to sort of get their mind around, which I like, because I like to read books that sort of provoke reflection and that kind of thinking.
Well, so you were just saying a few minutes ago that you kind of put this in the back of your mind. This wasn't like this ordeal was not the foremost event in your life as you were growing up.
No, I mean, obviously it influenced me heavily and was there, but it's a different time too. I mean, we just didn't, and the way I grew up, you didn't talk about, you know, you didn't sort of do the woe is me stuff, and it wasn't so, I just didn't use it in any way like that, and it was not something that was on the forefront of my mind. My father was, because I rediscovered surfing and skiing about a year after the crash, and that really lifted me out of my grief and so forth, but not sort of the airplane crash and survival thing and all that stuff. It just wasn't something that was on the forefront of my mind.
And what was your relationship with your mother like when you got home?
It was a pretty tough relationship. She was with a guy that she'd been with since I was about three, and he was an alcoholic, and we had, it was a tough time. I mean, he was very dogmatic, the boyfriend, and I think he was intimidated by my father and felt that he now had to fill those shoes and knew he kind of couldn't, and was, I think, in his heart trying to do the best for me, but had a heavy-handed approach and There was just a lot of arguing and intensity in that house. And you know, if I didn't have my dad's point of view, his just kind of his way of looking at life that came through on those trips I took with him, and the way he talked to me about things and people, and those gifts of being able to just go surfing and get away from it all and experience things that were beautiful and help lift my confidence. I would have had I could have really turned inward and sort of shut down.
Well, it's an amazing story, but it's also a very well-written book. Well, how'd you learn to write?
I wrote stories when I was a little kid. My mom saved some of those stories. They were detective stories. I was really into that. And so I always had an inclination for it. My father was a bit of a writer. He wrote Inside the FBI, and it's a pretty well-written book as well. And my grandfather was this great... too bad he didn't become a writer. He was worked for the telephone company, and he was the Depression and so forth, and that was his thing. But he didn't have the luxury of being able to write. But he was sort of in my blood, I think, a little bit. And when I was 21, I took off to Europe, and I was a ski bum, and that's a whole other story. I returned to where my father had taken me a couple times for a month, this little village in the Alps. And I learned, I had a little mini renaissance. I really learned that, wow, I think I want to write. That's what I want to do. And so I've been writing for 20 years, and when I was about 30, I got serious about it and moved back to L.A. from all my travels and just started writing full time.
Well, it's a phenomenal book, and it's called Crazy for the Storm, and the author and the man who experienced it is Norman Olsted. Thank you so much for being with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thanks for having me. It was fun.
That closes the book on this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. Hope you enjoyed the program, and I'll be back again next week with another great show. In the meantime, check us out on Facebook, iTunes, or our podcast page, KUSP.org. I want to thank our From the Bookshelf staff, Ms. Breanne Beal, for all of her hard work. Thanks, Breanne. Also thanks this week to Donna Gould. And especially thanks to Norman Olsted for being our guest. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.